Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Another episode of Off the Devil's Party. My name is Alice.
And my name is Rowan.
Rowan is back, folks. Peter kind of is the new co-host. Sorry. Don't know how that
That's
happened.
That's okay. I think he does a really, really good job. And I enjoy listening to Peter, so I guess everybody else does too.
Yeah, that's pretty much the feedback from everyone, is that Peter has a really nice voice. And I'm like, yeah, but all he of does. The knowledge? And they're like, oh yeah, that too.
It's the knowledge and the delivery.
You might be asking why we're going to do Vathek, because it's perhaps not the most popular gothic novel. Perhaps people might think it is a strange choice, but it's a common one. It comes up, and I think it helps frame a lot of the other ones, and you can see in real time how these tropes and ideas are being established and experimented with, but also because it's absolutely batshit crazy.
I am looking forward to trying to explain what happens.
And it's not just the book, it's everything around the book, it's the guy that wrote the book, it's just mad. It does figure on a number of gothic courses, it figures on the Dark Hero course, it appears there. And the question I always get from students who, are rushing week to week to read the text and read a full text in a week on top of all their assignments and their soul-sucking part-time jobs and their soul-sucking families and relationships and whatnot, they only have a dog to keep them going. Every week they say, or every time I teach this, they're like, why are you teaching me this? And I try and explain it to them, and some of them get it, but the rest of them are looking at me like, but why? Why did I have to read 97 pages of this? I still don't understand. So this is the background. This is the stuff that you don't get in the lecture, and I hope it interests people in some way. So because it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, Rowan has put together a plot summary for us.
I tried my absolute best. It took hours, and I still don't know if I caught everything. I think I've got all of the important parts, and I think lots of readers of Vathek will know that there is so much stuff happening that it's really hard to figure out what's important. And it's only now that I'm looking at it like, I could probably stuff this into, 27 dot points,
You're going to retell the plot for us, for those of us who have read it and perhaps not internalized it, because it is a book that expands as you read it. It seems to get longer. Before we get going, though, I should probably also mention our article.
Yes, our article. We have good news about our article. Our article about Eve, Milton, and Zafloya.
Zafloya and the Sublime.
Yeah.
It looks like it has been accepted. It's probably too early to say that it has been accepted, but we hope to bring you more news on that soon, because that's very exciting for the two people who are on this podcast and probably nobody else in the world.
Who are they? Where are they? I want to see him. He's excited about this shit. It's us. It's me. It's you.
All right. So, yes, take us away with the plot. Now, look, you're not expected to know how to pronounce these names. I don't know how to pronounce half of them. You do your best. I'll correct you if I know, and otherwise we'll move on. Because I've had people call this Vathek.
And it's because they were made up by
a lot of them have been made up. I've also heard people call it Vathek, which...
Okay.
Ew. I don't know what is right.
The H is there for a reason. Oh yeah, no, I can see that heck.
Yeah.
But it's a little funny. Okay, I will get into the plot. I did try hard to make this funny, but the plot line is already a bit of a joke. So there's only so much you can do with that. I did try to essentially just make it one big sentence, but even that didn't work, so I don't know how Beckford did it. Anyway.
He was high.
He was high. Can't wait to hear more about that. Okay, so Vathek is the 9th caliph of Abbasides. It's already so bad.
Nice.
The confidence. And he ascended to his throne in Samara when he was young, and he spent all of his time on that throne glutting his love of pleasure. So that includes food, drink, women, sensuality, blah, blah, blah. Essentially, his life is one big gluttonous holiday. He's built 5 palaces dedicated to the senses. Be a big glutton. He's also insatiably curious for knowledge, and so he builds a tower for astrology and, such things. And his mother, Carathis, uses it for nasty occult shit. So one day, a strange merchant arrives in Samara and sells Vathek some glowing swords, and they have words on them. The merchant refuses to answer Vathek's about Vathek's questions about the swords, and he's also immune to Vathek's potent gaze. So he sort of he looks at people in a certain way, and sometimes they just drop dead. It's just super potent and super sublime. Evil eye, yeah. So Vathek throws the merchant in jail, but the next day he finds that the merchant has escaped. Carathis, Vathek's mother, tells him that the merchant was spoken of in a prophecy and that he's a pretty important dude.
Already I have so many questions. We still haven't explained the glowing swords.
That's the second paragraph. This is like 1800 words.
Nice.
Buckle in, get a drink. So Vathek offers a reward and or punishment to anyone who can help decipher the messages on the swords. It's a carrot and stick situation. One guy finally translates the message, and it's essentially just a made in Eblis tag that also says the best stuff comes from Eblis, and Eblis, you know, hell sort of thing. The swords are magical, so the next day the message changes and says, woe to the rash mortal who seeks to know that of which he should remain ignorant, and to undertake that which surpasses his power.
Which should be ringing what bell in your head?
Probably all of them.
Faustian. Make a Faustian pact.
I thought like all gothic bells, but true.
Or, you know, aspiring to know more than what you're meant to know. It's Promethean as well, but yeah.
Okay. Vathek gets thirsty. And this happens a lot. He gets unquenchably thirsty. It is torture for him. One day when he is now, he goes to a bunch of fountains, four fountains specifically I have on this paper, near a mountain to drink. He hears the voice of the merchant, who he henceforth calls the Jiawa, which means the non-believer. The Jiawa gives Vathek a potion that cures his thirst, and Vathek takes the Jiawa back to Samara. Vathek then makes a fool of himself trying to out-eat the Jiawa in an impromptu eating competition, I guess. I don't know. They're both trying to be the biggest gluttons. Vathek makes a bunch of bad judgments as his role as caliph and risks disgrace. One of Vathek's visors passes on a message from Carathis, which foretells evil tidings for Vathek and his visor Morakanabad. The message also asks Vathek to ask the Jiawa about potion he gave Vathek in case it was... Vathek asks the Jiawa about the potion, but in response, he just gets laughter. Vathek then goes into a rage and kicks him, and this starts the first of the incredibly stupid plot points, and the rest of the plot is essentially just this, but blown up. The Jiawa curls into a little ball, big ball. Vathek kicks him again, and the ball starts rolling, and this incites a frenzy, and everyone nearby is compelled to kick the Jiawa ball, and the entire city, including the people who really you'd expect not to be kicking the Jiawa ball, including Morakanabad and Carathis, join Vathek in kicking the Jiawa ball all the way out of the city and into a plain called the Plain of Catul, and all the way to the valley at the foot of four mountains. Then the Jiawa ball plunges into a gulf, and everyone stops at the edge just before they fall in. And sort of reclaim their senses, except for Vathek, who camps there until he hears the Jiawa's voice from inside the gulf, and he says, give up Islam and I will take you to the Palace of Subterranean Fire with all of its treasures. A black chasm opens in the ground, and at the bottom is an ebony portal and the Jiawa with a golden key. The Jiawa demands the blood of 50 boys, and Vathek stages a festival to trick 50 sons of his visors to go towards the cavern, and then he chucks the boys in one by one, which all happens over a number of pages that feels condensed. But the chasm closes and Vathek isn't taken to the Palace of Fire, and he gets super mad. The people realize what Vathek has done and form a mob to take revenge. Carathis tells Morakanabad, who lost two sons, and yet is still sort of loyal to Vathek, but only for one more task. She tells Morakanabad to calm the mob, which he does, and then everyone returns Vathek to the palace.
And if that wasn't enough...
Wait, there's more. Carathis tells Vathek that he needs to fulfill his promise and make a sacrifice to the Djinn of the Earth. So she and Vathek, who has since become super hungry, he's not super thirsty now, but he's super duper hungry, go to the top of his tower for magical reasons, and they produce a magical light. The inhabitants of Samara believe that there's a fire, so they climb to the top of the tower to save Vathek. Carathis sacrifices the people who climb to the flames into this into some flames. There's about 140 of them. So she essentially does what Vathek did. She just throws them in one by one. Thanks to the sacrifice, though, they learn that in order to be rewarded with the treasures and delight of Eblis, Vathek needs to travel to Istakar and not accept any hospitality along the way. So Vathek leaves the city with his servants and wives because he is not a light traveler. A week later, his group is attacked by wild animals, but they continue on. They reach some mountains and Vathek is invited to rest with Islamic dwarves who want to convert him back to Islam. He was really just pulling shit out of a hat.
Yeah, I forgot about the Islamic dwarves.
Yeah, it's so much happening. Everything happens all at once. His mother sends him a message to kill the dwarves rather than accept their hospitality, but Vathek ignores it because he's a big baby who likes to sit on cushions and drink and eat. So he rejects the Giaour's instructions and accepts hospitality. He follows the dwarves to their valley and meets Emir Fakreddin and his daughter Nurhanahar, both of whose names I have royally fucked up.
I think Nurhanahar is right.
You reckon? Oh, thank you. Yeah. 50%. Vathek wants Nurhanahar as his wife. I'm pretty sure she's young. Pretty yeah. young.
I mean, that's the rules of this world, right? She's 12.
Yeah, true. Yeah, she's 12 and ready to be married. So he wants her as his wife, but she's already promised to her cousin, Gulchenrouz, and she likes Gulchenrouz.
Which is the least weird thing about this whole text.
Oh, yeah. You're like, yeah, no, these two seem good together. They're cousins.
They should stay together. Feels mean to break them up.
Yeah, it does. So Vathek asks his eunuch, Bababalook, to kidnap Gulchenrouz, but Gulchenrouz escapes. The Emir finds out that Vathek is seducing his daughter, so he drugs her and Gulchenrouz, a la Juliet. They both seem to be dead, and he hides them in a secluded valley. They wake up, and their caretakers tell them that they're dead and in purgatory, and they're going to stay there for a while. Nurhanahar wanders the valley and encounters Vathek, who has stuck around the area, mourning her death, like crying into rocks and shit. Mm. Nurhanahar abandons Gulchenrouz then to be with Vathek. Meanwhile, can we have sound effects? Meanwhile...
Back at the farm.
Yeah, it's not quite like an alternative plot because it's all the same plot. It's just messy. Meanwhile, Carathis gets a message from Vathek's favourite wife, Delara, telling her about Nurhanahar and how Vathek has disobeyed the Giaour and accepted hospitality. Carathis rides a creepy, creepy, super fast camel to visit Vathek and finds him in the bath with Nurhanahar. She says, son, I need you to drown this girl. And he's like, no, I want her to be my queen. So Carathis decides to appease the Giaour by sacrificing Gulchenrouz. But he runs away from her and into the arms of a genie who takes him up into the clouds and protects him. As a side note, Beckford adds that this genie caught all of the boys that were thrown to the Giaour by Vathek, the 50 boys, so the Giaour didn't get any kids, which is why he didn't give Vathek the key the first time, and why Vathek needs to go on a journey. But that night, Carathis sees a bad omen and uses magic to discover that Moda Vakal, Vathek's brother, has led an uprising against Vathek and taken control of Samara. Carathis returns to Samara, and Vathek and his caravan, which includes Nurhanahar now, trek for 4 days to the valley of Rochnabad to better gain favour with the Giaour, and also for a little fun. Vathek tramples the beauties of Rochnabad, the gardens, and humiliates the citizens and holy men. He ties some of them backwards on their donkeys. And they hang out there for 2 days, being a bunch of shits, and then they move on to the mountains of Istakar. A genie asks permission to save Vathek's soul. We're transported just to wherever that's happening. And the genie takes a form of a shepherd whose flute makes people reflect on their sins. And he plays it for Vathek and his caravan as they approach the mountains. He tells Vathek to return to Samara, take Nurhanahar back to her father, destroy his occult tower and stop taking advice from his mother and to return to Islam. He says all of those things separately. Vathek momentarily reflects on this and on his guilt, but then his pride overcomes all reflection. Ding, 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 the bell's ringing again. And he refuses the shepherd's advice and the shepherd vanishes. Most of Vathek's servants desert him at this time, so he and Nurhanahar continue with a handful of people to the ruins of Istakar. Vathek finds writing on some of the ruins that says he has violated the Giaour's conditions, not to accept hospitality, but because he stole Nurhanahar from his father and because he's so dishonored from her father and so because he's so dishonored the Emir's hospitality by doing so, he'll still gain entrance into the Palace of Subterranean Fire. The mountain opens and an abyssal staircase appears. Big surprise. They descend and find a familiar ebony portal and the Jawa with the key in his hand. He opens the portal and they enter a grand space so large that at first they think it's a plane. There are grand marble columns, gold dust and saffron on the floor, wine and crystal vases and genies. And there are also genies of both sexes and other spirits doing sexy dances everywhere. There is also an immense crowd of people with their, thank you for the sexy dance, hands in the air.
It's just for you.
So there is also... It is! That was good. It was sort of like a sunflower waving in a breeze.
Don't tell them.
Okay. They can imagine it then. There is also an immense crowd of people with their right hands on their hearts, and they're all moving incessantly. Some of them are running and shrieking, some of them are in a daze, but none of them can see anyone else around them. They seem to not notice each other. Vathek and Yoronaha ask the Jawa about these people, but he says that they'll all know soon enough. They'll know all soon enough. And then he takes them to meet Solomon, /Eblis, who sits on a globe of fire. Vathek and Yoronaha demand to be taken to the talismans that rule the world. Solomon tells them that he was once a great ruler, but that he received power from a djinn, and that as punishment he is doomed to suffer until a cataract beside him stops flowing. Vathek sees that Solomon's heart is on fire and begs to be let out of the palace, and also begs for Muhammad's mercy. The Jawa tells him that he has a few days to enjoy the treasures of the palace before he and Yoronaha will both suffer like Solomon. So essentially, Vathek is like,
Don't put me with a good time.
Yeah, he's like, we'll come back to that. He's like, oh no, I have made a mistake, let me out. And the Jawa is like, no, too late. So Vathek and Yoronaha wander these spectacular halls hand in hand, but they're in apathy. They fear the moment that they're going to have to let go of each other and begin suffering. Vathek blames his mother for his vices and the corruption of his youth, and he calls for Carathis to be brought to the palace and then spend some time speaking to other people who are waiting for their suffering to start. Carathis arrives and happily plunders the treasures of the palace, including the talismans, penetrating, quote-unquote, the very entrails of the earth. From page 93. Eblis tells her to enjoy her time while she has it. She's a little taken aback, but then does exactly that. Essentially, don't threaten me with a good time. She takes his word for it that she's going to start suffering, so she starts to enjoy very fast. She even tries to dethrone a Solomon to usurp his place. But before she can do that, Carathis gets an agonizing head pain. Her hand flies up to her heart and she spins off in a whirlwind so fast that she's invisible, and her heart begins to burn. At about the same time, the same thing happens with Vathek, Yoronaha, and the people they were speaking to. Their hearts catch fire as they lose, quote-unquote, the most precious gift of heaven, hope, page 94. They all spring from each other in horror and revulsion, and with the right hands placed firmly on their hearts, they join the multitude that aimlessly wanders the palace in anguish. And the book ends with a note about people needing to be humble and ignorant, and also a side note on how Gochenruz passes ages and ages in tranquil and undisturbed childhood, and that's it.
So if you read this and you thought, I don't understand, and you have now listened to the summary and you think, I don't understand, it's because it's ununderstandable.
Yep, nothing else we can do. It is impenetrable.
You will note the same, the trope of Gothic novels that you need to justify them. It doesn't come at the start necessarily, it comes at the end, after it all. Just when you might think, oh, you might have been having a bit of a laugh here, Beckford getting away with all of this. No, it's morally justified in the last couple of sentences through the comparison to Gochenruz and the moral that people should be humble and ignorant. Ignorance is an interesting choice as well.
Yeah, and it really does sort of come out of left field. It's the last two paragraphs, the stuff before has been completely horrible, and it's just like, let's quickly return to this one child who is having a great time, and he's very happy, and not Vathek. And you should be like him.
Yeah, don't be like Vathek, the person I've been writing about for 94 pages. Be like the one from the last two paragraphs who lived okay and didn't have a good time and have sex in all the baths.
Yeah, be like this twink who was engaged to his cousin and then got kidnapped by a genie and spent forever
you
being a child.
Also,
like, okay.
You should marry your cousin.
You should marry your
cousin. Post haste. Do you have a particular favourite moment?
Actually, I like that creepy ass camel Al-Bufaki, he's like, he likes the smell of graveyards. He's like, he smells a graveyard and he's just like, that's the shit. And he like, you know, gets energized from it. He just likes the smell of graveyards. Right. And I'm like, that's pretty cool. And you know all about camels and devils, right?
I was going to say the link, there is, you won't believe me, but there is a devil camel. Because in The Devil in Love by Jacques Cazotte, the devil initially, or Satan initially appears as a camel. And then there's a lot of shape-shifting. He's a page boy. He's a pretty lady. He's a page boy again. He's a black poodle at one point.
Aren't we all?
But initially, a camel. On the head of a camel, actually. Not a full camel, just the head, I think. So
head popping out of a window?
That's the image. I think I've shown you the image of the devil appearing to him. There's so much to be said about it, and there's a lot to be said about the stuff around it. So I'm going to sort of start out and we'll work our way in. We're going to do a lot of context here, which I find interesting. So if you don't, go listen to another podcast. I don't care.
this podcast has context.
For me, and look, honestly, I think Peter and I spent an hour and 40 minutes on one of the episodes just contextualizing something the other day, so we're fine, I'd say.
That's good. So, that's an hour and 45 minutes of context you won't get anywhere else, folks. This is the exactly. Context podcast. Come get your comms and your texts. On that point, read the fucking text. Sorry, it's been a long 6 months. Go on.
Well, I wanted to start by talking about Beckford, because I've specifically given you instructions not to read the notes for this one. Normally Rowan knows what's coming, but I have so many fucking
Should I be looking at the notes now, or just not bother?
No.
Okay, just, I won't bother.
I'm just going to tell you some stories.
I'll just look
here.
At you.
So, Beckford was an art critic, a travel writer, a collector, a novelist, a politician, a composer, and plantation owner. He never traveled to the Middle East, though. He never went there, so that might raise some eyebrows, but we'll come back to that. Yes, a plantation owner. He claims to have written Vathek in one sitting and in French. So these are just some early contextualizing things, and I'm going to go into it a little
degenerate
bit more.
Degenerate French!
One person said that to you one time. You have not let it go.
I cannot choose what sticks and what doesn't. I'm like one of those fly traps. I'm just honey on a piece of paper. Shit sticks sometimes. Sorry, you were saying that he wrote in French?
He claims to have written it in one sitting and in French. He definitely wrote it in French because it was later translated. But whether or not he wrote it in one sitting, look, it would explain how crazy it is. Like, I would also write that in one sitting if they said, you are high and drunk, now write something until you're done, you can't leave the room. Because I think that's what, you know, some of my students do when they write creatives. He was the son of a well-known politician by the same name, who was Lord Mayor of London, and he had vast plantations in Africa. He was born in Jamaica, he served in the militia there, and then he was sent to England to be educated, and he was back and forth between Jamaica and England. So he was a career politician, was Vathek's father. He supported the Whigs, you know, despite being a huge fan of the sugar trade. So we think of this time as very polarised, I suppose, between the Whigs and the Tories, between the abolitionists and the slave traders and slave owners, but there was some grey area, apparently. A school was named after him as part of his legacy, but during Black Lives Matter it was renamed. His son, who we are more interested in, was considered England's richest commoner. Now we're just going to pause here because that is Rowan's greatest dream.
I would love to be England's richest commoner. Oh my god. Imagine how much shit I could buy. I'd pay for all my friends' surgeries. I would
have many useless shaped candles.
Treats all the time. No, I don't like candles. I would have like an abundance of vases just in case I happen to go outside and smell the roses and I want to cut them down and put them in a vase. That would be nice.
So just to put that into context, he was getting £100,000 a year, which
Holy
in 1780
shit.
Would have equated to about 17.5 million pounds, English pounds, or 30 million Australian dollars a year.
A year?
Yeah.
A year? Where do you even put that sort of money?
Well,
how do you spend
it? I will
it?
Tell you.
Hedge funds.
I will tell you where he put it, Rowan. We know exactly okay. what the fuck he did with it. Squandered it.
He kept receipts.
He was briefly trained by Mozart, which I just couldn't find anywhere else to put that, but I wanted to make a point of
what?
It. Music.
Yeah, but okay. I think I'm asking a question that's gonna make me seem dumber. Like a type, like an instrument.
I don't know, man. It just said he was trained by Mozart.
He was trained in the kazoo. He was
in the xylophone.
He's a slave owner, so he was trained in the kazoo. That's all he gets.
He married Lady Margaret Gordon, but he was at least bisexual, and letters to William Courtney, the 9th Earl of Devon, surfaced and caused some scandal, and he fled the country. He subsequently chose to exile himself on the continent with his long-suffering wife, who died in childbirth, age 24. Can you imagine being 24 Jeez. Years old, and you've married a rich twink, and, like, you're stuck with this bastard, and then you die in fucking childbirth?
Not fun. No,
if you feel bad for anyone, feel bad for the women in this story. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
He was also having an affair with his cousin's wife, Louisa Pitt. So good for him. And look, there's so many sexual scandals, we're just going to pepper them in throughout.
Oh, yeah.
As a writer, Beckford is remembered for Vathek, of which the reception from every quarter may have satisfied his ambitions for a career in belles-lettres. Sorry, Patrick. And for his travel memoir, Italy, with some sketches of Spain and Portugal. He followed Vathek with two parodies of current cultural fashions, the formulaic sentimental novel in modern novel writing, and The Elegant Enthusiast and Azemia, a satire on the Minerva Press novels, which was rude of him. He also published biographical memoirs of extraordinary painters, a literary prank burlesquing serious biographical encyclopedias.
Wow, what that's the summary you get off Wikipedia. Boring dude.
Yeah.
Why? He had
time and money, he could do whatever he wanted.
Encyclopedias? I would start a cult! Start a cult!
Well, no, hang about. Beckford left two daughters, the younger of whom, Susanna Euphemia, sometimes called Susan, was married to Alexander Hamilton, not that one, and inherited the majority of his collection, which was then moved to Hamilton Palace, now demolished. The elder, Margaret Maria Elizabeth Beckford, married Lieutenant General James Ord. That's kind of like an overview of the man, but let's go deeper, shall we? As this text asks us to do. As a child, he was obsessed with Eastern tales. Andrew Elfenbein has remarked that readers today are likely to associate Beckford with the stereotypical gay man who loves antiques, china, liqueur, manuscripts, paintings, and bookbindings. And although before Beckford, collecting on a grand scale did not necessarily involve associations of homosexuality, after Beckford, it most certainly did, because he foreshadowed shockingly beautiful things as a distinctively gay option. After Beckford, reading the Arabian Nights as a script to be reenacted in forbidden ways, emerged as a distinctively queer option. And I've written after that, lol, what? I read that three times and I just... It had to go in.
Are you saying that he was like a sort of... Hang on.
You trademarked gayness.
You ever be so gay that you trademark shopping as a gay activity? Like, seriously?
Forget queer eye. Vathek's evil eye. He's just taking like the Jawa out for outfits.
We're also considering that, as you said before, at least bisexual. That's also bisexual. At most. Like, sir.
No one can pin it down, and we have to remember that this time they had no concept of gayness is the way we would now.
Okay,
it was just that
so just,
they had sodomy, yeah. Which yeah. wasn't even just anal sex, it was any kind of unnatural sexuality. Or that was like seen as away from God, because
so, like,
you weren't
a foot
trying to conceive.
Fetish or...
Yeah, all of that sodomy.
Yeah.
Mm.
Wild.
You dirty.
Okay.
Sodomite.
You dirty sodomite. Stop. Stop. Stopping there. Okay. So he was. So you're saying after Beckford, instead of being like. People asking, like, is he, you know, and then, like, flicking their wrists out,
they'd
like...
be like, he has nice wallpaper.
Yeah, no, yeah, they'd be like, oh, yeah, nice wallpaper. They'd be like, does he, you know, shop? Is he a shopaholic?
I told you that this whole episode was just going to be a live react to crazy facts.
Crazy facts.
It's living up to it.
It is.
So, in any case, he is able, in Vathek, as he had been previously able during the infamous Christmas party at Fonthill in 1781, to displace once and for all his cousin Peter Beckford, master of foxhounds, supreme representative of the squirearchy, a perverse alter ego, and demonic double whose response to the creolizing West Indian taint of sugar money had been to become more English than other English people. So it seems also that writing for Thek was about, like, pissing off his cousin. So that as well. Now, let's talk about Fonthill Abbey and the Christmas party of 1781, Rowan.
Because I'm incredibly invested in Fonthill Abbey and the Christmas party of 1781.
You're about to become as such. So, okay. It has been described since as an Oriental reenactment of Arabian Nights. Perhaps what Vathek is based on. Now, I will explain Arabian Nights in just a minute. The difficult thing here was ordering things, so we're going to start with this and then build off it. Okay, so, you know, he claims that this is what Vathek is based on. Maybe, maybe not. We don't actually know. This is Beckford on the party itself. Delightful indeed were these romantic wanderings. Delightful the straying about this little interior world of exclusive happiness surrounded by lovely beings in all the freshness of their early bloom. So to enjoy it. Here nothing was dull or vapid. Here nothing reassembled in the least the common forms and usages, the train and routine of fashionable existence. All was essence. The slightest approach to sameness here was untolerated. Monotony of every kind was banished. The delirium of delight in which our young and fervid bosoms were cast by such a combination of seductive influences may be conceived, but too easily. It was, in short, the realization of romance in its most extravagant intensity. No wonder such scenery inspired the description of the halls of Eblis. So he's describing probably an orgy.
Ah, I was going to say he sounds high off his tits, but you're probably...
That too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the first sentence kind of flags it. What was it? Like the delight of their youth or their breath?
Romantic or... wanderings, yeah.
Yeah.
Their bosoms. Their fervent bosoms.
Fervent bosoms. That's right. Bosoms do be fervent sometimes. Yeah, no, that was
so
probably
it was a
orgy.
Party of debauchery and gluttony and hedonism and good for them. Good for them.
Good for them.
And this is in part what apparently inspired Vathek. I started thinking that perhaps this is the OG dark academia, like they get together in a castle and have an orgy for 3 days and then a book is written about it where everyone ends up in hell.
I think I just got a book idea.
No, please don't rewrite this. I beg of you.
I will do it. You cannot stop me.
So Donna Landry, in Arabian Nights and Historical Context, writes that Vathek William Beckford subsequently claimed was a reenactment of the three-day event he had staged at Fonthill. So imagine a three-day orgy. How tired would you be? Hydrate, which was itself a reenactment of the Arabian Nights. The central machine of the reenactment was created by Philip de Lutherberg, who had designed scenery, lighting, and other theatrical events for Garrick at the Drury Lane Theatre. So they had a director for their orgy.
Wow.
Ian McCallum has brilliantly described de Lutherberg's achievement at Fonthill as a virtual seraglio, I don't know that one, a novel experiment in virtual reality and a forerunner of digital technologies of immersion. So it was a sexy VR, I don't know. McCallum comments, at the heart of the medium lies the concept of immersion, to plunge viewers into a visual and sensory space that integrates them in a perceptual and emotional relationship with the surrounding images. The idea is to create an illusion of being inside a total alternative world, untied in time and space. Immersion was exactly what Beckford was seeking, both in his party and in his reenactment of it while writing and later rewriting Vathek. You ever had a director for your orgy? Rowan is processing. The wheels are spinning.
No, because I just spent a week at Quest, which is, you know, a week of being immersed in like a medieval world, and cogs are turning, but I don't know what the heck they're doing. That's...
I keep saying it's probably a sex thing.
That's an ad. Quest?
Yeah.
It wasn't for me. God. Okay, right, so they've essentially brought the theatre. I'm just thinking of how freaky that would be. Like, you have somebody who works in the theatre, and you get them to deck out your house, and you're like, yeah, I don't want this to be my house anymore. I want this to be, like...
an orgiastic phenomenon that even, like,
yeah.
James Cameron would appreciate.
Based on the Arabian Nights as well, and you're in the middle of England, it's -2 degrees, there's a sheep outside, and you're like, yeah, this is gonna go well, this is gonna go great. And it does, because
it
of how
does.
Many drugs you've had. You've had all
so,
of them.
This kind of suggests, or people have implied, that there's an interest in the occult sexual. At the time of the Fonthill party, years into her marriage, Sophia was entangled with Louise's brother. Don't try to keep track of the names. The Honourable George Pitt, ostensibly Louise's chaperone. It was rumoured that they were hoping a pregnancy would commemorate this weekend liaison. Anyway, Sophia Musters became framed for her beauty and sat to Romney, Hoppner, and at least four times to Reynolds. They're all painters. Significantly, one of these Reynolds portraits of Sophia, now at Kenwood, represents her as Hebe. Was there a code share between Louisa and Sophia, and between Beckford and Reynolds? Timothy Mao notes that Hebe was cupbearer to Zeus before she fell, exposing herself indecently, and so came to be replaced by Ganymede, a beautiful boy whom Zeus disguised as an eagle carried to Olympus on his back, and the implication is that he has relations with him. Mao comments, Riley, such ironic symbolism must have delighted Beckford. We might go further and suggest that Beckford may well have suggested this imagery to Reynolds. Louisa proceeds, preparing the way for Beckford's own Ganymede, Courtney. Hebe, with his nectar and ambrosia serving link to exquisite forms of consumption, deserves further investigation as a Greco-Oriental trope. So again, just to add another layer to this party, there's also, like, they want to have a baby, there's, like, trysts and triangles between relationships.
So much happening at this party, and there is so much happening in Vathek. I can see why there is a connection between the two.
So Landry also says the queer subject appears doomed to serve deprivation and disgrace. In May 1783, Beckford had married Lady Margaret Gordon, a daughter of the 4th Earl of Aboyne, and would father two daughters with her before she died of childbirth in 1786. When the Courtney scandal broke in 1785, during a visit to Powderham Castle in Devon, because of course it did, Lady Margaret loyally defended Beckford and decamped with him to the continent, and that's where he remained in exile. When he returned to England in 96, he collected manuscripts and rare and exotic objects, tore down Fonthill, and erected in its place the mock Gothic Fonthill Abbey. Beckford is reported to have quipped Campley during these years, "It's cruel to hear talk of fair boys in dark jade vases and not buy them."
Sorry, ignore me. I'm just going to laugh at that.
See, I told you not to read the notes for a reason.
Yeah.
With its 12 miles of 12-foot-high walls and perpetually rebuilt tower, all 276 feet of which collapsed in 1825, just 3 years after he sold it to pay his debts, which, remember, $30 million a year. How the fuck do you have debts? Beckford's estate was a kind of Xanadu, and he the Caliph of Fonthill. That's the man, the myth, and the legend.
The man, the myth, and the motherfucking what the hell did you do with your money? Give you debts? Where you get debts from? How can you have debts?
All these vases and boys.
All these vases and boys? You see, I understand the vases. I understand what you need the vases for. But all the boys as well. What the shit?
So that's some background on Vathek and the craziness he got up to, and that's
where
the Christmas party.
Have time to write. This is what I don't understand.
His collection really was amazing. I looked at some catalogues of it. Pretty much any good book on Vathek, critical work on Vathek, has in some way in its appendix, or in its list of appendices, some new catalogue or whatever on what he had in the Abbey, and oh my god, it really was a museum. I would have paid entry, not to the orgy necessarily, but to see all the stuff. And I did start trying to make a list of like some of the important things, and then I thought no one is going to care except me and maybe two other people I know, so I just...
Well, at least one of them is here, so you're obviously welcome to. It sounds like sort of Library of Alexandria sort of thing, except it's owned by, like, a rich, insane bisexual in the late 1700s England.
Right? This is the thing. Nobody knows about Beckford, but I feel like he'd be a gay icon if more people did. Except
he was also a slave owner.
Yeah.
Probably best not to be an icon. Just like that.
Problematic.
Yeah. I think... he's... Fuck, man. So much stuff happens all to this one dude. Around this one dude. My god. Go on, then. What's the next thing?
So, that brings us to our discussion of Orientalism. So, 1001 Nights, or 1001 Arabian Nights, is translated into English from French. And he read this in childhood. Beckford taught himself Arabic and Persian as a relief from Greek and Latin, which says more about Greek and Latin than it does about Arabic and Persian. But that's incredibly impressive. he collected folk tales compiled in Arabic, and just for context, Arabian Nights was translated into French in 1704 by Antoine Galland, and then translated into English sometime between 1706 and 21 by various anonymous Grub Street authors. Do you know what Grub Street is?
It was a little publishing street Lots of grubs. Just one street. Go on, tell me.
So, yes, it was a street. Hack writers.
Yes, hack writers.
Yeah, lower class and doing what others saw as hack work. But a lot of important stuff came out of there. I was just reading the other day how many of those writers that Joseph Johnson, who was a prolific bookseller at the time, commissioned to do various little jobs and probably didn't pay properly. So, do you know the framing story of 1001 Nights?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is a girl called Scheherazade. Okay, you're shaking your head. I think there is a girl who's gonna marry this dude, this super powerful dude. But like every time he gets married, he kills his wife like the morning after. And so she's like, I'll tell you a story. And she tells him half the story and promises to end the story the next night over. And so he doesn't kill her. And I think she does that to like, I don't know, save her sister or something. Or to, like it's.
Well, she doesn't want to die also. And then they just fall in love.
As far as I know, but this is completely bastardized. Because I haven't read 1001 Nights.
No, yeah, she tells him 1001 stories to stop him from killing her, and then that makes him fall in love. So get yourself a man like that, ladies and gents.
Yeah, get yourself a man who will kill you until you tell him 1000 stories. And then he
And makes you do all of the emotional work in their relationship.
Okay,
so
yep.
The thing was floating around. So just some other versions. So Madame de Genlis wrote a comedy in 1780. Adi de Marini's Histoire de Arabes, so History of Arabs. Bartholomew de Herbelot in Bibliothèque Orientale in his entry. Scottish Orientalist John Keaton's poem Scenes of Infancy. All dealing with Oriental ideas. But Beckford's is the most developed story about anyone called Vathek. Others named Edward Wortley Montagu's translation as the source, and there's debate about whether it was a translation, Vathek's attempt to do so. Lawrence Chatel in William Beckford, The Elusive Orientalist, which was probably the best source I had on this, because there's not a huge amount written on Vathek, argues that he might have stolen a third of the Arabian Nights volumes from the Bodleian. He had them on loan, and Chatel thinks he didn't bring them all back.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that's funny as well.
You got so much money, you gotta steal books.
That there's all of this drama and stage work and puff Hilarious. And smoke, and he might have just stolen a book. The hunt for an act of plagiarism or theft has now reappeared in post-colonial readings of the novel. It's often presented as an imperialist appropriation of Oriental material, which it presents as fictitious, pretending to diffuse knowledge and admiration for the East, while in fact colonizing the Orient. And again, that's Chatel. So these revisionist readings sort of starting to see it more in that light. And a lot of students kind of are unwilling to see it in any other light, which can make things difficult. It's like, yes, I know, let's look at the other stuff involved. So I'm sort of always in two minds about that. I want to give them space to explore that, but also want to teach them the text and all the other stuff that's going on, rather than just the revisionism.
Oh no, I was going to say that it's had an influence on the canon before we understood it as a revisionist text at all. So you do need to understand those readings in order to understand the canon that produced those revisionist readings.
And just the context of the text in and of itself is interesting, and if... Yeah, and if you rule it all out as revisionist, Peter calls it the sausage maker. You just end up with the same stuff every time sausage. Rather than a really nuanced understanding of the text. Nuanced sausage. Yeah. You want sausage with bits in, you know? So, in his famous work of Orientalism, Edward Said said, a new powerful science for viewing the linguistic Orient was born, and with it, as Foucault has shown in The Order of Things, a whole web of related scientific interests. Similarly, William Beckford, Byron, Goethe, and Hugo restructured the Orient by their art and made its colours, lights, and people visible through their images, rhythms, and motifs. At most, the real Orient provoked a writer to his vision. It very rarely guided it. He also claims that Sir Walter Scott got his knowledge of the East from Beckford, which I thought was interesting. So that's the only mention of Beckford in any of Said's work, and essentially it just reinforces what we know. Beckford represents the East, but in fact he just kind of alienates it and becomes an English version of the East. It becomes further colonised in their culture, which is problematic. But Romantic Orientalism, which is what it is, was in vogue in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. It was fashionable. As we see, you know, I guess Byron can be understood a little bit because he travelled there. The Dower, but also, yeah, a little bit in John Juan.
I just remember his costume, his Persian costume. Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. That famous portrait of him in his in his garb is how he wants to present himself as the bringer of the East to the English world, and that's part of his celebrity and the appeal. But by Orientalism and what we mean by Romantic Orientalism, it sort of characterized the East as the other, as demonic, as violent, as extravagant and indulgent, as we see through the five pleasure domes, the endless buffet, the gluttonous appetites. The fact that he devoted his time to the sole gratification of his senses, he was much addicted to women and the pleasures of table, the eternal insatiated banquet in the first palace, right, that is apparent. Palaces themselves where exotic artifacts are collected, but also hedonism, indolence, sensuality, and, interestingly, the incapability of governing yourself. Which is so ironic because that whole party was about
that's true.
A lack of self-government.
Seems like someone is displacing their anxieties onto an entirely different, like, mishmash of cultures.
And he's the one in debt despite getting 30 million quid a year. As Alan Richardson has stated, Beckford's work manages to evoke and exaggerate a whole set of invidious Orientalist stereotypes, beginning with Vathek himself, a tyrant, sensationalist, sadist, and devil worshipper.
Amazing.
So these are all things that people associated with the East. But now we just associate it with, like, English people at that time.
Which is probably a...
He also says, in Vathek, the Orient is predominantly evil, representing all the seven deadly sins in the persons of the royal family, of the caliph and his mother. The tale opens with emphasis on Vathek's pride and sensuality. He is a person bent totally on the gratification of the senses. His palaces, which are described in dazzling details, are dedicated to these five senses. His fifth palace represents... his lust with reference to the Horus. If there is any goodness in the world, it is presented in weak, helpless persons or in the pitiable common people, or Gulchenrus. In a world generally evil and devilishly grotesque, goodness and innocence cannot survive without supernatural help provided here by the good genie. Even Mahomet is helpless to protect the innocent. So he's seeing, like, this old... The East is bad. All the bad bits of Christianity, all the things Christians hate, manifest in this other world, when really it's just a projection of all of the bad things in Christianity that they're not willing to deal with. Because they don't know anything about the East, so they just make it up based on what they don't like and what they don't want to be, but they are.
Oh yeah, that checks.
Though is, I've seen a few times people say that, or people have suggested, that he wrote Vathek in order to write the notes that go along with it about the East. Again, I can't validate this either way.
I think that claim might actually be in the introduction.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, that's where I've taken it from. Yes. Sorry, yes.
Sorry.
I thought you were saying that the explanation for that, or, like, the real... I don't know where that comes from.
No, I've got nothing to add.
Okay. Furthermore, he also says, Vathek's despotism and the total subservience of his subjects are highlighted throughout. The subjects are ironically referred to as good Muslims. Like Vathek, his subjects are sensualists. The subjects of the caliph, like their sovereign, being great admirers of women and apricots from Camuth, felt their mouths water at these promises. So imagine being a great admirer of women and apricots. Those are your two defining characteristics. The whole culture is presented as such, a culture of voluptuousness, sensuality, decadence, indolence, and ease. Even piety is derided. Pious Muslims like Fekreddin and his grey old beards, the dwarves with their Qurans, and dromedaries are sarcastically presented. Same with the other dignitaries like mullahs, sheikhs, and imams. They are deliberately made to look ludicrous, always humiliated and insulted. The dwarves are the most devoted creatures and the truest, most helpless followers of Mahomet. This definitely carries a symbolic meaning. Even references to Allah and his prophet Mahomet are accompanied by the air of lightness. Vathek is ironically described as commander of the faithful. Thus, the Muslim religion and its people are ridiculed through Vathek and the ignorant superstition and subservience of his subjects, who, no matter what he does, still venerate him as commander of the faithful. The religion of Islam and its prophet Mahomet are helpless to save the good Muslims from the humiliation, suffering, or death, nor can they correct the corruption of evil. Vathek and his Jawa, the emissary of Eblis, reign supreme. Sayyid's general statement about the Western vision of Orientals or Arabs as gullible, devoid of energy and initiative, much given to fulsome flattery, intrigues, cunning, and unkindness, is aptly illustrated in Vathek, which I think is a really great summary of the way Orientalism is presented. A little bit more on this, I think it's worth kind of going through in some detail. Three things in Baba's argument are surely applicable to Vathek. The fixity of the stereotype, its constant repetition, and its being at once the subject of desire and derision. In Vathek, the characters are all the familiar Oriental Gothic stereotypes. They are portrayed both to dazzle the imagination with their magnificently luxurious sensual life and to arouse one's derision because of the barbaric excesses and violence. There is a vein of caricature that now and then comes to the surface and invites a laugh without disturbing the sense of Eastern opulence and extravagance in a tale crowded with incident and action. This kind of ambivalence is characteristic of this tale. The reader is led through a myriad of attitudes and impressions, from the descriptions of exotic, sensuously breathtaking gardens, natural scenes, and luxurious palaces in the style of the Arabian Nights, to the idyllic, pleasurable life of Princess Nouronnahar and her cousin Gulchenrouz, to the shocking farce atrocities in the depiction of the Caliph's debasing habits, his malignant avidity, his importunate appetite and gluttony, his killing eye, unpredictable cruelty and disrespect for his subjects, and his paroxysms of passions, which make him the most laughable spectacle, his ludicrous relationship with his harem, his numerous wives, always kept and guarded in cages, his degrading spectacle, as he is saved from fire by one of his Ethiopian wives, who clasped him in her arms, threw up upon her shoulder like a sack of dates, to the Jawa's grotesque appearance, his satanic games, his demand for the blood of 50 innocent children, and his ridiculous treatment of the Caliph, to the introduction of the magnificent Tower of Samarra, where the wicked Carathis, under the guard of 50 female Negroes, mute and blind in the right eye, enjoys her favourite amusements, preserving the oil of the most venomous serpents, rhinoceroses' horns, and woods of subtle and penetrating odour, together with 1,000 other horrible oddities, through which she achieves intercourse with the infernal powers, whatever that means, and finally to the sombre magnificence of the tragic end in the halls of Eblis. Now, just first of all, that is one sentence.
That's insane.
So, don't do that.
Take a breath. Take a second.
No, just like, part of the reason I put it in, I was like, it's one sentence.
It's amazing.
Who edited that?
The clauses.
Mm.
But it does sort of mimic Vathek, and I was listening to that whole thing. Like, I feel like I'm reading Vathek again, which might be the point.
I think perhaps it might be.
It's a very crowded sentence.
That may help make sense of the text and why it is the way it is, because it is this gratuitous reenactment or engagement with the ideas of Arabian Nights, where Vathek just wants to, like, be in it as much as he can, and also to present it through this very English Western colonial view that they had. So that is why. So perhaps it is part of this greater force of propaganda about the East and of the East. And also he just liked the pretty colours and the wallpaper.
It's just so much.
Do you think at the time when Vathek's mother dropped him off at prep for the first day, she might have said, "This is William, he's a bit much."
I mean,
this is maybe. Bill.
Bill. Oh, I don't think he would have gone by Bill. I think he would have killed someone for calling him Bill.
Willie.
Bill Beckford. Willie. Willie Beckford.
So that's an overview of the most Eastern and Oriental parts and what people said about it and why it was there. So I also wanted to talk about its reception and influence, because, okay, this is how we see it today. Did the people at the time also realise that it was fucking crazy? Let's talk about it. So Joan Cootey in Persuasion and Propaganda said that Beckford squandered the family fortune with his magnificently silly Fonthill Abbey, yet contributed positively to English culture with his Book of Vathek, which, after Horace Walpole's Castle of Otranto, is England's truly gothic fantasy. What a burn/compliment.
That's amazing. That would hurt me.
Magnificently silly.
I aspire. Look,
if you had £30 million a year at a giant castle, you wouldn't give a shit.
I would be magnificently silly. Absolutely not. I wouldn't give a fuck. I'd erect a magnificently silly statue in honour of her comments and make it even sillier than Fonthill Abbey.
Madame de Stael said, "I believe the Arabs are less extraordinary than Mr. Beckford."
None, and neither of them has ever met somebody not from England before, so they don't know anyway.
Now again, he claims to have written this in 3 days and 2 nights in a fit of passion, and yes, it was originally published in French. In an 1877 New Monthly Magazine article entitled "Gleanings from Anglo-Oriental Literature," Vathek was cited as one of a group of novels that offer a picture of Eastern ethics and the consequences thereof. That Beckford made it possible for readers to see his work as one that might refer to the East in a more general sense is further illustrated by his choice of a title character. Beckford was surely drawn to the gore of Vathek in large part because so little was known about him, and since, in the words of Hugh Kennedy, his very anonymity presented an opportunity for the use of imagination, which he did. But it is also significant that, as the reader is told at the outset, the historical Vathek was the grandson of Harun al-Rashid, and therefore came to power some time after what certain of Beckford's contemporaries would have understood to be the high point of the Abbasid Caliphate. His name, familiar even to our infancy through the medium of the Arabian Tales, as Nathan Drake wrote in the Literary Arrows in 1798, Harun al-Rashid was the most potent monarch of his race, a lover of learning art and science, and a warrior of the East, who presided over an Augustan period of civilization at a time when Christian Europe was still in the Dark Ages. So, you know, he's infantilizing and making fun of someone who is probably, you know, historically quite an important and powerful figure, or related to one anyway. So people knew.
Yeah.
People realised.
Yeah.
Robert Selby was one later writer who took the Arabian milieu of Beckford's work very seriously, and he directly compared his Oriental epic Thalaba the Destroyer, published in 1801, with Vathek. Hester Lynch Thale famously wrote that Vathek was a mad book by a mad author. Interpreting the tale's luscious descriptions of Gulch and Ruse, for example, as an unseemly public display of Beckford's favourite propensity.
Yeah.
What do you think his favourite propensity is?
Your ass is showing, Beckford. Boys! Probably.
But yeah, something like that. He also gets a mention.
Beckford, your gaze showing. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Gator. He also gets a mention in Canto 1, Stanza 27. 22 of Childe Harold.
Interesting.
So, written by Byron. On sloping mounds or in the vale beneath are domes where whilom kings did make repair. But now the wildflowers round them only breathe, yet ruined splendour still is lingering there. And yonder towers the prince's palace fair, there thou too, Vathek, England's wealthiest son, once formed thy paradise as not aware when wanton wealth her mightiest deeds hath done. Meek peace voluptuous lures was ever wont to shun. I hope I got the meter there, right there. Well, I think that it's interesting that Byron is drawn to him. Obviously it makes sense. He was interested in the East. He was interested in the gays. But, you know, this is another man who basically had to exile himself because of his sexuality one way or another. So it is interesting that he stands out to Byron, and Byron makes note of him among, you know, and he talks about lots of authors. As we know, he had Dacres in Childe Harold. That's kind of the reception. People knew, people read it, people thought it was crazy, people thought it was an interesting study, people liked the campiness of it, and it, you know, it's it associated shopping with the gays.
Making mind-blown hands.
I also just love the, a mad book by a mad author. Like, that's from a contemporary.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
We come to, like, our job here, which is what kind of a hero is Vathek? Now, when I taught this in class this year, the opening...
Oh my god, we're not here just to shit talk.
So, when I taught this semester, and this was the week that I thought I was just filling in before I had to, like, fully take over. But anyway, I was greeted at the start of this class of, isn't he just a bad guy? But that set the rest of the class up. They were like, yeah, why are we doing this? He's just a bad guy. It doesn't fit. I'm like, okay, let's work through this.
Yeah.
It's really a test to my pedagogical skill. So, I mean, what do you associate him with of dark hero-ness?
Okay, so the quest for the curiosity for knowledge, the insatiable curiosity for knowledge, incredibly heavy association with the way dark heroes tend to look. So they have, like, freaky eyes, you know, this sort of, I don't know if I'd call him brooding, but, like, really intense. There's a sort of, I don't know, a little bit of hyper-masculinity to him.
Like, and at the same time, weird feminine energy.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it's a strange mix. The fact that he's selfish. Dark hero. Pretty selfish. And now that I think about it, he's...
It's unhealthy, you know, selfishness. It's unhealthy self-interestedness. Yeah.
Yeah. He's very prideful.
There it is.
And, yeah. And now that I think about it, I don't know if he has, like, if you were just looking at, you know, Byron's dark heroes, he probably doesn't have as much in common with them as some of the other dark heroes that we've looked at do.
Well, yeah. He is often simply associated with a gothic villain. He's not... Even though he's the protagonist, is he heroic? And, you know, I've met people who mount arguments that he is for what he does. I just don't find them very believable.
What does he do? I think he's just... It's heroic.
Well, yeah. He just keeps marching into the abyss. Like, I don't think that's heroism. I think that's stupidity.
I will face backwards and I will face God and walk backwards into hell is what he's doing. And that's it.
While throwing confetti.
Yeah, no, he walks straight into it. Yeah.
So yeah, he's a gothic villain, and I think Beckford was establishing him as such. He's the first Eastern Gothic villain. He's taking these two ideas from culture and melding them into one. And we can see that through the evil eye. So we have the quote on page one, his figure was pleasing and majestic, but when he was angry, one of his eyes became so terrible that no person could bear to behold it. And the wretch upon whom it was fixed instantly fell backward and sometimes expired. For fear, however, of depopulating his dominions and making his palace desolate, he but rarely gave way to his anger. What weirds me out about Vathek is he's so, like, dependent on everyone and so flimsy and, like, has no strength of character or will, and yet he has enough anger and power that he has this evil eye. Like, the two don't...
Yeah, and he also has the self-control not to, like, kill everybody that pisses him off, apparently. It doesn't make sense. As well as the whole, like, goth, like, how with how villainous he is and how much he defers to his mother. That's always something that I've found a bit complicated to understand, especially because he has so many periods where he's, like, too hungry or too thirsty or too depressed to do anything. He just, like, sits in his tent for days and days and days. Yes, we do. but I'm like, okay, this is the big bad of this book, and he has been, like, catatonic with thirst, and that's it for the past 3 days. It done nothing.
yeah. It doesn't seem consistent with his character, does it? And maybe that's part of his commentary on the East, or maybe it's because this was ostensibly written in 3 days, and so he didn't really edit it much. I don't know. I was reading today, and I knew that, like, Vindication of the Rights of Women, and even Vindication of the Rights of Man, was written incredibly fast by Mary Wollstonecraft, and everyone kind of is a little bit down on it sometimes because of the errors and whatever in it. But she reworked it very soon after. Like, this is this, you know, common thread in discussion, like, oh yeah, it's good, but it's badly written. And it's like, well, it was, but then she made it better. So I don't know why it's hung around. Anyway, that's not important, I guess, for today. So Thorslef, our old friend.
He's back.
He mentions Beckford once.
Oh yeah? What'd he say?
He says, but his most strikingly gothic feature is his evil eye. So he's talking about the gothic villain. This is in that chapter. That traditional hallmark of such varied figures as Mrs. Radcliffe's Shidoni, who I want to look at, Schiller's Armenian, Beckford's Eblis and Vathek. He doesn't even talk about actual Vathek as having the evil eye. Lewis's Wandering Jew and the Ancient Mariner. Several scholars have attributed it to the fad of mesmerism, but Byron had heard of the evil eye in the Middle East, because of course it comes from there as well, and then it links in with the tradition and the gothic of the gothic villain having, like, a piercing eye that sees straight into your soul. So that's all Thorslef has to say, which I always find surprising.
Why do you find it surprising?
I don't know that this text was super influential today, but it was so influential and important at the time. Like, other authors certainly knew this existed, and it was kind of conceptualizing a lot of cultural ideas that were floating around. Like, it put it into text and into narrative, and so it became influential that way. Like, I guess we can't, like, draw direct lines, but it was there in the soup of the world, and people read it and knew it, and it was popular. So you'd think that Thorslef would maybe talk more about how it influenced a certain type or species or subset of the dark hero or even the gothic villain, but he doesn't, and that's something that is that's like my academic career as it goes up, my faith in Thorslef goes down. Every week I find something more.
I've
wrong.
Noticed that, actually. I remember you talking about Thorslef during your honours year, and I was like, oh yeah. And then every time you reread it, you're like, I've found another hole in this book.
And look, it's very short. Like, it's not as thorough as it really could be. It's something that, you know, once you open that up, you can go on and on and on and on. You can have subchapters. I mean, I have had that problem with my own thesis. So yeah, in a way, he has a very tight, not even tight argument, but like a very clear, this is what I'm doing, and everything else is thrown out. But also that sometimes happens at the cost of good points and discussion of the text and, like, more helpful, relevant discussion.
Yeah, no, you could.
So, Vathek. The name literally means blasphemer or infidel. So, pretty close to Satan. So we've got the evil eye. We also have his pride, which probably should stand out to you more than anything else. And then that is what associates him with the various traditions. And I've pulled a couple of quotes on this. The main one is, His pride arrived at its height when, having ascended for the first time the 1500 stairs of his tower, he cast his eyes below and beheld men not larger than Pismir's mountains, than shells, than cities, than beehives. The idea which such an elevation inspired of his own grandeur completely bewildered him. He was almost ready to adore himself, till, lifting his eyes upward, he saw the stars as high above him as they appeared when he stood on the surface of the earth. He consoled himself, however, for this intruding and unwelcome perception of his littleness, we've all been there, bro, with the thought of being great in the eyes of others, and flattered himself that the light of his mind would extend beyond the reach of his sight and extort from the stars the decrees of his destiny. I mean, that's lovely. That's a lovely, well-written passage.
It is.
With this view, the inquisitive prince passed most of his nights on the summit of his tower to becoming an adept in the mysteries of astrology, just from sleeping under the stars. He imagined that the planets had disclosed to him the most marvellous adventures, which were to be accomplished by his extraordinary personage from a country altogether unknown, prompted by motives of curiosity, blah, blah, blah. So again, he's incredibly educated. Like, he knows a lot as well, despite who he is. And, you know, it's another inconsistency in his character. He just lies on the roof for a few nights and then somehow knows everything about astrology.
Yeah, it seems almost like... when creating the Thek, Beckford was sort of doing what you do with your Sims sometimes, is that you can pick a Sim that has, like, really horrible stats and they're an absolute slob, but you just force them to, I don't know, play chess for, like, 6 days straight, and suddenly they're the smartest person in town. It's sort of like a cheat code. You want them to be, like, yeah, my Sim is super-duper smart, but, like... it's been forced.
I didn't know that.
It just, it does feel sort of forced.
Huh.
Yeah, you can do anything in The Sims.
While you were doing that, I was playing Roller Coaster Tycoon and, like, throwing people off the end of a roller coaster or dropping them in lakes.
Damn. Yeah. I was doing Sims and, like, taking the ladders away from swimming pools. It's an easy way to do it. It's that, or you build, like, a little room and just lock them in there and leave them there for, like, a week. And it, honestly, I don't usually feel bad about killing video game characters, but my god, the week-long starvation, incredibly difficult to watch. I was like, who would do that?
Me, I'm God.
I did
and
that.
And suddenly, God makes more sense, because God is a 14-year-old child who doesn't want to do their homework.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah. And who's, yes, put us in the microwave instead. Put the hamster in.
So, yes, he's proud.
We digress.
And this is initially represented as an empowering quality. That's what's important. But slowly it is revealed as kind of associated with his insatiability, right? He thinks he's better, so he needs to know more. He needs to have more power. He needs to, you know, he needs to be able to eat more. He needs to go more places. He's not satisfied with what he has because he thinks he's better than everyone else, so he needs access to those things. So the pride initially is kind of like... kind of a good thing because it enables this level of learning and kind of a greater understanding of the world, but soon corrupts, and that is the point. Tale as old as time.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Because, yes, he wants to rule the world. Treasures, blah, blah, blah.
Treasures, blah, blah, blah.
Sorry, I'm just...
He is also Faustian, right? He's very clearly associated with the Faustus figure. So the big, you know, highlight neon signs of this. He studied so much for his amusement and the life of his lifetime of his father as to acquire a great deal of knowledge, though not a sufficiency to satisfy himself, for he wished to know everything, even sciences that did not exist. He was fond of engaging in disputes with the learned and did not allow them to push their opposition with warmth. He stopped with presence the mouths of those whose mouths could be stopped, whilst others whom his liberality was unable to subdue, he sent to prison to cool their blood, a remedy that often succeeded.
You just throw people in jail when they don't agree with you.
You just talked about putting your Sims in a locked room. This couldn't have been better flow on from the previous point.
I said you. I didn't say me. I can do what I want.
Oh, it was just the royal you, was it?
Yeah, it was the royal you. Damn! And that's really, I think a really important thing about Fethek as well, is that, like, yeah, okay, he's super smart, he loves knowledge, he's insatiably curious, he's spent years studying, but at the same time, he throws other academics in jail if they disagree with him. It's the concoction of the good parts of his pride and the bad parts of his pride.
Yeah, I mean, who can... That's unheard of, eh?
Oh yeah, I've never seen it before. Did I just mansplain something about...
Also, you certainly are possessed of every important science, but the knowledge of language is a trifle at best, and the incompetent of none but a pedant. This is... I think he says it to the Jawa. Oh, the old man who, like, reads the sword or whatever, who translates the sword. Yeah, the Jawa. I'm sorry, I'm getting confused. I just think it's funny. It's like, yeah, the thing you know is stupid anyway.
How does it feel to be the smartest person in a really stupid field? That's what he's saying.
Yeah. Woe to the rash mortal who seeks to know that of which should remain ignorant and to undertake that which surpasses his power. So again, that's on the Sable. We talked about that before. And that is the big Faustian / Promethean. Yeah. Flag. It's like, don't know too much.
That is a mallet with the word Faust on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's being bopped on the head with Faust. Well, we are being bopped on the head.
Well, it's both, because it's not asking you to make a pact yet. It's the knowing more than you're meant to know. So it's probably Promethean and then Faustian by implication, because he then makes the pact with...
He does make a pact, doesn't he? Yes, he does.
Yeah, eventually.
Yeah.
So one night, however, while he was walking as usual on the plain, the moon and stars were eclipsed at once, and a total darkness ensued. The earth trembled beneath him, and a voice came forth, the voice of the Jawa, who in accents more sonorous than thunder thus addressed him. Wouldst thou devote thyself to me, adore the terrestrial influences, and abjure Muhammad? On these conditions I will bring thee to the palace of subterranean fire. There shalt thou behold in immense depositories the treasures which the stars have promised thee, and which will be conferred to those intelligences whom thou shalt render propitious. It was from thence I brought my sabres, and it is there that Solomon ben Daoud reposes, surrounded by the Solomons, the talismans that control the world. The unhappy caliph, instigated by insatiable curiosity, lavished his promises in the utmost profusion. The sky immediately brightened, and by the light of the planets, which seemed almost ablaze, Vathek beheld the earth open and the extremity of a vast black chasm, a portal of ebony. We know this. He just responds immediately. He's like, yeah, cool. And it's none of Eve in the garden going, oh, a talking snake. Or perhaps it is, because the whole point is she doesn't stop to question it. He's just like, ah, a voice. Sure. Yeah, whatever.
It's offering me stuff. Oh, yes.
Now, you have to ask yourself, if you were walking home one night on the plain with the moon and stars, and it was total darkness, and a sonorous voice of thunder addressed you thus and promised you these things, would you say yes, or would you ask questions first?
I mean, if I felt that I was so... Like, if every now and then I climbed a tower and I thought, I am more important than God... I would certainly not question it, but that's not me.
You don't think you're more important than God?
I feel like this is a trap.
It's not. It's a very innocent question.
I would question why this voice is talking to me, but then of course the answer would be because I am more important than God. Of course this voice is talking to me. It's promising me everything that I want. And then I
do
whatever
it says. Well,
that's
certainly what Vathek does. So... obviously, he says yes, he kind of makes this pact. He asks for the blood of 50 children, and he fancies himself as great as Solomon when he does throw the boys in, so again, it's about his pride and power. And later on, when he says no language could express his rage and despair, he execrated the perfidy of the Indian, loaded him with the most infamous invectives, and stamped with his foot, as resolving to be heard, he persisted in this till his strength failed him. Like, kind of like Faustus, because he commits himself to the devil, or to the dark side, or to, you know, the bad guys, he... loses the ability to be empowered by anything good. And Faustus has the decision right up to the end, and then he says no, and then it's too late. He doesn't in this scheme, because obviously it's Eastern, and they don't understand the machinations, the world-building of the religion over there. They just know the names, and they make it up as they go along. But he commits, and then suddenly everything, I guess, that did empower him, or was even slightly good about him, even the good parts of his pride, are kind of rendered powerless and impotent. Which I think is an important kind of part of his characterization.
Sort of
tainted. He's Faustian and Promethean in the sense that he wants more knowledge and he makes a pact with the devil, and we see how that affects him in real time. He's not Promethean in the sense that Prometheus at least had some justification, and even Faustus was like, I want to know more, I'm very curious. He just wants power and blood and to feel better than everyone.
Yeah. Are we gonna eventually get to the question of where is the good bit? You know, does he have a? Is there someone that he loves? Is there any sort of redeeming quality about them that we could use to argue that he's a dark hero? Or do we never?
Go on.
I don't know if there is. He's a bit too much of a, for me, he's a bit too much of a caricature, and there's way too much contradiction in him.
The only kind of, I think, even slightly compelling argument is that he does have the ability to love, it's just even more of a projection of his love of himself. Like, he loves Naranaha, but he loves her because she's hot and she likes him. So...
And he's also got, like, a bunch of other wives beforehand.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, yeah.
So he has the capacity to love, but not the capacity to love to the point that he can put anyone above himself. and I guess he knows a lot, but that's not necessarily a virtue.
Mm. Yeah.
No, there's not a lot of redeeming qualities. The point, I guess, of looking at him is in comparison to these other figures and the way these tropes and ideas are being represented by Beckford in this different, a different way. It's not another spooky castle. Yeah. We're in a palace of subterranean fire in somewhere in the Middle East, which is, you know, there are camels. There's also the question of free will throughout the text and whether Vathek even stood a chance, which, again, perhaps there is an argument here. Poor Vathek, the victim. God made him
He's
the way
he is. Such a man-child that, oh, God. I do not have any sympathy for him because I'm like, you're a man-child. You'd be a horrible housemate. And, like...
I like that's how we're like, basing, we're judging people now.
Yeah.
How much are they going to ruin your life?
Ah, I get it. Yeah.
Scum. Right.
We're not even doing the two beers and a puppy test anymore. It's would I have this person as my housemate?
The great Prophet Muhammad, whose vicars the caliphs are, beheld with indignation from his abode in seventh heaven, irreligious conduct of such a vice regent. Let us leave him to himself, said he to the genie, he who are always ready to receive his commands. Let us see to what lengths his folly and impiety will carry him. If he run into excess, we shall know how to chastise him. Assist him, therefore, to complete the tower, which, in imitation of Nimrod, he hath begun. Because if you didn't pick up on that kind of biblical allusion, not, like that great warrior, to escape being drowned, but from the insolent father, as to acquire a great deal of knowledge, though not a sufficiency to satisfy himself, for he wished to know everything, even sciences that did not exist. He was fond of engaging in disputes with the learned, but did not allow them to push their opposition with warmth. He is stopped with presents. Oh, we've already talked about this one. By this means, he induced the zealots to oppose him and then persecuted them in return, for he resolved at any rate to have reason on his side. So the great Prophet Muhammad, whose vicars the caliphs are, beheld with indignation. Why have I got that twice? Okay. The point here is that Muhammad says, yeah, leave him be. Let's see what happens. Doesn't intervene. Doesn't do anything. Kind of sets him up. So it's almost... Because, I mean, he did it out of free will, but he didn't have help that other people had. I don't know, there's an interesting question there about the intervention of God.
And there's very little intervention. I think the only intervention is when the genie asks to try. The genie cares a lot more about it than Muhammad at that point. And so God is just like, eh, yeah, give it your best shot, I guess. You can
also
try.
Also, I think the decision not to intervene is kind of an intervention in and of itself. Like, we're going to stay out of this. Okay, well, that means that he doesn't get the help that you get, so you are still kind of affecting what happens.
Yeah, because the forces of darkness were certainly trying. They reached out to Vathek first, you know?
They knocked at the door with chocolates.
Yeah, exactly. And God was like, ah, that doesn't really feel like my territory anymore. It's like, dude, you've not done anything.
Well, again, it's The Sims. He's like, all right, let's lock him in a room for 7 days and see what happens. Let's fuck around and find out.
Yeah, he went to hell. What did you expect? No shepherd. Shepherd too late.
So again, it's that callback to, like, in Paradise Lost where God says, you know, where the devil... Satan thinks he's operating out of free will, but in fact, it's still within the grand scheme of God. God has still decided this is how it's going to be and what's going to happen, so that's what's happening here as well. Also, Vathek is a bit pathetic.
Are we talking pathetic in the sense that he's a loser?
Yeah.
Yeah, he is.
So let's have a look at some of those instances. As the exercise of his faculty seemed to be suspended, one of his Ethiopian wives, for he delighted in variety... clasped him in her arms, threw him upon her shoulder like a sack of dates, and finding that the fire was hemming them in, set off with no small expedition, considering the weight of her burden, metaphorically and physically, The other ladies, who had just learnt the use of their feet, followed her, their guards galloped after, and the camel drivers brought up the rear as fast as their charge would permit. So he is rescued by his wife. Now, good, go her, whatever, but it is presented as pathetic.
Which is a very, very funny thing to do in a your gothic villain, I guess.
Can you imagine? Pathetic? Actually, Ambrosio...
Manfred.
Ambrosio would be tossed over Matilda's shoulder.
Oh, yeah, Ambrosio's pathetic.
But I'm thinking of Radcliffe's villains. Like, no one is chucking Montoni over their shoulder and running from the room.
No.
He'd rather certainly burn in the fire than simp to anyone.
Oh, yeah. And... It's so childlike, and that's another thing that keeps on coming up in Vathek, especially with his relationship to his mother, is that he just seems at sometimes like an infant throwing a tantrum, completely helpless, helpless to his own desires and to the fact that he can't, what is it, when you control your desires, he's got no self-control.
Self-control. And then,
yeah, he's got no self-control. He's a victim to his own lack of self-control. Which is, yeah, he's just like a little monkey on a string.
Well, he's also compared to Gulchenrouz, who's the most delicate and lovely creature in the world. Ali Hassan, who had been absent 10 years on a voyage to the unknown seas, committed to, at his departure, this child, the only survivor of many, to the care and protection of his brother. He could write in various characters with precision and paint upon vellum the most elegant arabesque the fancy could devise. His sweet voice accompanied the lute in the most enchanting manner, and when he sang the loves of Megnon and Layla, or some unfortunate lovers of ancient days, tears insensibly overflowed the cheeks of his auditors. The verses he composed inspired the unresisting languor, so frequently fatal to the female heart. The women all doted upon him, and though he had passed his 13th year, they still detained him in the harem.
Fuck.
His dancing was light as a gossamer, waved by the zephyrs of spring, but his arms, which twined so gracefully with those of the girls, with those of the young girls in dance, could neither dart the lance in the chase nor curb the steeds. He's just the opposite, maybe?
He's just a gothic heroine, sort of.
Hero? Oh, heroine!
Yeah.
He's also kind of a hero. Like, some of the gothic heroes are kind of useless and flimsy and feminine, actually. They're, like, too busy quoting poetry to help put the house, like, put the fire out of the house.
Yeah.
Or late to rescue the woman because they were looking at another woman in a window or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and I'm just thinking of when Gulchenrouz, you know, runs away from Bababalook as well. Like... He's trying to be caught. He's trying to be sacrificed. If this podcast was where are the gothic heroines, I'd say it would be Gulchenrouz.
Well, at the end, he's the one that comes out on top, and that's what happens
Because of his virtue.
So it's here. I've got the quote. Thus, the Caliph Vathek, who for the sake of empty pomp and forbidden power had sullied himself with 1,000 crimes, became a prey to grief without end and remorse without mitigation, whilst the humble, the despised Gulchenrouz passed whole ages in undisturbed tranquility and in the pure happiness of childhood.
Yeah.
He comes out on top.
So what is important about the comparison between Vathek and Gulchenrouz, besides from this wonderful snippet of didacticism?
Well, as I was saying before, I think it's... Neither is an ideal, but you're meant to compare these different types of men and maleness. And I also think that that Beckford perhaps was projecting onto Gulchenrouz a little bit. And yes, establishing a gothic hero. So the last kind of heroic subtype that may have influenced Vathek's characterization, I think, could be Satan. Just in the sense, like, the way he preys on Nerunahar, you know, the time in the Hidden Paradise is Edenic, and they are told Vathek is not there because he is damned beyond redemption, and then he turns up in Paradise and he takes her out of it. Like, I always read that as Satan arriving in the garden and being like, hey, Eve, because that's the other thing. Gulchenrouz, he's the good guy, he comes up on top, he's Adam. He withstands, he doesn't fall, whereas everyone else does. So... there's that, but there's not much more to it. It's just that scene is so Edenic and so evocative of that story. It stands out. there's an argument here that some of it is just satire, and I don't know, you can play, like, is it satire, is it insane? Is it satire, is it insane? So the 40,000 kicks on the guards, the insatiable thirst, the jar rolling into the bowl, the people whose sons are murdered, appeased by Carathis and Babaluk, throws money into the crowd, and we feel bad for him when his tower burns, having to walk for the first time on the earth, talking to fish, pinching to death. All of this stuff is batshit crazy. Yeah. And there is an argument also that the Jawa could be seen as a kind of Mephistopheles. But, importantly, he's not compelling or sympathetic, but he has what Vathek wants. And I wonder if that kind of, I'm going to say misrepresentation of Mephistopheles is part of the satire as well. Making fun of that style of writing. Or you could just read it as Oriental, and they're trying to represent the East as wacky and zany.
Probably all of the above, at least to some degree.
Circle D for all of the above.
Yeah. I feel like there's way too much craziness for it not to be satirical, at least a little bit.
I agree. Yeah, I don't know. If he wrote it in three nights, probably not, but he probably didn't, so I'd say there's some, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's the question of whether or not it's satirical relies on the question of whether or not Beckford was sane.
And that's a question we are not going to be able to answer.
Nope.
Until we meet him in hell. So, yeah, we're so fucked.
The last thing I want to talk about is Carathis. Because she's the most interesting character in the book.
And she's incredibly important.
Yes.
Actually.
So, she is the mother of the protagonist, and this is central to her characterization. As a mother, she is ostensibly, according to Kenneth Graham, represented as a non-sexual being. So she cannot be empowered by her sexuality. So, you know, woman in Gothic text, often, you know, identified via sexuality in some way. Even Lady Macbeth has to represent herself as untethered from her sexuality in order to characterize herself, and that becomes a characterization associated with sexuality one way or another. Kenneth Graham further says, Carathis is an ironic parody of the mother figure in traditional romance. Her wisdom is in the form of knowledge of the occult, and her advice is accompanied by a domineering that Vathek finds impossible to resist. When Vathek strays, she places him firmly on the truth path, the path which leads ultimately to his damnation. I mean,
hilarious.
She doesn't want to damn him, though. She just wants the power he's going to get.
Yeah. And I do think she... Oh, God. Yeah, I'm finding it difficult to separate the things that she does for Vathek and the things that she does for Vathek that do things for Carathis, you know?
Everything is for Carathis. She's the smart cookie. And that's the thing. Yeah. Muhammad didn't sit back and go, oh, Fathek's doing some interesting stuff. Let's see what happens, and let's also see what's going on with Carathis. Like, there's an inconsistency there, because he surely sat back and was like, these two, let's see what happens here. But she's just not mentioned in that context.
Yeah, that's true. She does seem like sort of... It's almost as if she's in the story of her own volition.
Oh, yeah. She has ultimate free will.
Yeah.
She's God also. So at the beginning of the text, her mothering support for her son is her defining characteristic. So, for example, the outcry which soon resounded through the streets of Samara at length reached the ears of Carathis, his mother, who flew in utmost consternation to try her ascendancy on the mind of her son. Her tears and caresses called off his attention, and he was prevailed upon by her entreaties to be brought back to the palace. And then later, Carathis, apprehensive of leaving Vathek to himself, had put him to bed, and seating herself by him, endeavoured by her conversation to appease and compose him. Nor could anyone have attempted it with better success, for the caliph not only loved her as a mother, but respected her as a person of superior genius. So that's nice.
That is nice. Rare weird in Gothic fiction. My mother is super duper smart, way smarter than I am.
And I
acknowledge
her.
That.
And she put me to bed and tucked me in.
And she tucked me in. She heated up my milk and everything.
However,
holy shit.
Later in the text, a new dimension of her character is introduced. Carathis, whose affliction no words could describe, instead of confining herself to sobbing and tears, was closeted daily with the vizier Morakanabad to find out some cure or mitigation of the caliph's disease. Under the persuasion that it was caused by enchantment, they turned over together, leaf by leaf, all the books of magic they might point out a remedy, and caused the horrible stranger whom they accused as the enchanter to be everywhere sought for with the strictest diligence. So she sort of, it starts off being about her motherliness, but then things turn. She has a lot more freedom, so that's how she has the subterranean vault, where she enjoys some intercourse with the infernal powers to whom she had ever been passionately attached, and to whose taste she was no stranger. And I think that's kind of recalling the idea that women, you know, witches were expected to have slept with the devil. So it's making it sexy because he's recalling that idea and kind of associating her with witchery. You see, although Carathis has access to infernal powers, she did not have a direct relationship with the devil. Instead, she uses the infernal power she manages to access as leverage over her son, who becomes reliant on her skills. The way she exhibits her power over Vathek suggests a more independent access to the sublime than she has previously been given credit for. This is my argument. This is me.
I can see it. No, I can see the dots. I see what's happening.
I'm connecting things. I'm
connecting
things. So, you know, women previously, like, think of Matilda and the Monk. She gets her power, ostensibly, through the devil. Okay, that is what is said at the end of the book, and whether she was acting as an independent agent throughout is kind of up to question, but you know, what is said is that devil gives her power. Carathis just gets it. She just collects it from the world. God ain't looking at her, devil ain't looking at her, because she's a woman and a mother. She's just operating in the background, doing her magics.
Fucking busy!
She's busy, and she's sublime. So, no sooner had the Caliph re-entered the palace that Carathis commanded the doors to be fastened. By perceiving the tumult to be still violent and hearing the imprecations which resounded from all quarters, she said to her son, "Whether the populace be right or wrong, it behooves you to provide for your safety. Let us retire to your own apartment, and from thence through the subterranean passage known only to ourselves into your tower. There, with the assistance of the mutes, who never leave it, we may be able to make a powerful resistance. Babaluk, supposing us to be still in the palace, will guard its avenue, and for our own sake, and we shall soon find, without the counsels of the blubberer Morakanabad, what expedient may be the best to adopt." Vathek, without making the least reply, acquiesced in his mother's proposal. So he's been in charge, he's the dude with the tower, but she commanded, and he acquiesces. So that's our first clue.
Yeah.
And it is Carathis to whom primarily Vathek answers and who controls his respect, and she is described as like a chameleon who could assume all possible colours and inflated with the venom of her projects. Carathis has an inexplicable sublime power that provides her superiority over her son, and most often it is her will that dominates in the text. Like, Vathek thinks he knows what's going on, but he never does. He's just...
No.
Also, I've just got also. Either I will perish or Vathek shall enter the Palace of Fire. Let me expire in flames, provided he may reign on the throne of Solomon. Having said this, and whirled herself around in a magical manner, which struck Morakanabad with such terror as caused him to recoil.
Nice. Yeah,
it's like, it's there. It is that sublime response. And we're talking here about the Burkean sublime. Whatever excites feelings of terror and awe has to be sublime. So, she is terrifying and awe-inspiring. Later on, Carathis, still seated on her camel, foamed with indignation at the spectacle which obtruded itself on her chaste view. She thundered forth without check or mercy, "Thou double-headed and four-legged monster!" This is when she finds Vathek and Nornahar. "What means all this winding and writhing? Art thou not ashamed to be seen grasping this limber sapling in preference to the scepter of the pre-Adamite sultans? It is then for this paltry doxy that thou hast violated the conditions in the parchment of our Jawa. It is on her thou hast lavished thy precious moments. Is this the fruit of the knowledge I have taught thee? Is this the end of thy journey? Tear thyself from the arms of this little simpleton. Drown her in the water before me and instantly follow my guidance." So she doesn't just inspire control. She demands it. She demands fear. She demands. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something. And I've just been thinking of how Vathek himself has some sublime qualities, like his evil eye, for instance, that I doubt he'd ever turn on his mother. Mm-mm. And the fact that she can tell him what to do and he won't even reply, he'll just acquiesce to it immediately, says a lot about how sublime she is, just by implication.
Amen. Like, he doesn't use the eye as much as he could, right? Every situation he's in, he would just be like, "Bah!" and then done.
Yeah.
It would fix the whole plot. He could even do it on the Jawa. Anyway.
This book would actually be 6 pages if Carathis had a shotgun, and I wish she did.
So, a lot of this is taken from my paper for the RSAA conference last year, which is on my academia if you want to read it, people. I was going to turn it into an article, but I haven't had time, so I've just put it up there. Maybe I'll turn it into something eventually, but it's like about the development of sublime women and how it eventually manifests in Victoria, because I think there's a thread running through. I think you've read the paper. I think you know what I'm talking about.
I was going to say, you might have to write that paper.
I will, but actually, I have a few things to do, so it can get in line.
Things to do.
She also says, "Glutton that thou art, were it not for me, thou wouldst soon find thyself the mere commander of savoury pies." Which is such a fucking burn.
He's also more pathetic.
You'll be a basic pie maker if it wasn't for me. And only savory pies. Yeah, she's like,
oh, what are you, king? King of the fucking pies? Not even dessert pies, savory pies, you piece of shit.
When Carathis does eventually arrive in Hell, it becomes apparent that she hasn't met the devil previously, and she has not subjected herself to him in return for power. And that's the thing we see, that's always the pattern, right? She's, you know, sleeps with the devil, gets power, or makes pact with devil in some Faustian way, gets power. That women are dependent on the devil or some sort of channel to the infernal in order to empower themselves, rather than just possessing it in and of themselves. I think this is, like, something Carathis has that most other, like, figures of this sort don't, and that makes her a sublime woman. So, let's look at it. As she was emerging from one of the abysses, Ebla stood forth to her view, but notwithstanding, he displayed the full effulgence of his infernal majesty. She preserved her countenance unaltered and even paid her compliments with considerable firmness. So she looked the fucking devil in the eye and was like, how do you do?
Yeah. Pretty good, eh?
Girl power.
Maybe she's born with it. That's it. Maybe she is.
God just Maybe she didn't have to fuck the devil.
Yeah. She looked the devil in the eye and walked forwards into hell to pillage his stuff.
It's like, nice face you got here. Have you thought about putting an ensuite in?
Yeah.
So, he says, princess whose knowledge and whose crimes have merited a conspicuous rank in my empire, and that's an amazing compliment. Let us well to avail thyself of the leisure that remains, for the flames and torments which are ready to seize on thy heart will not fail to provide thee soon with full enjoyment, he said, and was lost in the curtains of his tabernacle. Carathis paused for a moment with surprise, but resolved to follow the advice of Eblis. She assembled all the choirs of genii and all the dives to pay her homage. Thus marched she in triumph through a vapour of perfumes amidst the acclamations of all the malignant spirits, with most of which... of whom she had formed a previous acquaintance, so she knows them somehow, even if she's not empowered by them. She Amazing. Even attempted to dethrone one of the Solomons for the purpose of usurping his place, when a voice proceeding from the abyss of death proclaimed, "All is accomplished." Instantly, the haughty forehead of the intrepid princess became corrupted with agony. She uttered a tremendous yell and fixed her right hand upon her heart, which was become a receptacle of eternal fire. So it's kind of like when Satan arrives in hell and he is triumphant and he's like, "Ta-da! I did it!" And then bam! Talking snake.
Yeah.
Well, not even a talking snake, that's the point.
Like, non-talking snake, even worse.
It's a recall of that moment of instant fallenness, and she doesn't realise until the very last moment that it's happened, and that shows how bad she is, but also it shows how fucking impressive she is, because she's like, oh, this is nice, yes, I'll have your throne, I'm wandering through a vapour of perfumes, you guys all know me, aren't I amazing? And they're like, yeah, baby.
I have an entourage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's more impressive the more I read it.
And it's meant to be not impressive. You're meant to look at her and go, that sinful bitch. But you look at it and go, yeah, baby.
She did good. She's been busy. The devil is literally like, hey, you're about to be super duper busy, like, being in agony. So you should probably, like, celebrate while you can. And she just hears, celebrate.
Pick up treasures.
Yeah.
So, Carathis is punished for her knowledge and her crimes, but she marches into hell triumphant. Although she bursts into flames in her last moments, it only further reinforces her sublimity. Mm. She's even more sublime compared to her son, who, when he hears his sentence, only aversion and despair could be seen in Vathek's eyes. He also earlier insisted that it was not thou that brought me hither, the principles of which Carathis perverted my youth. There is nothing triumphant or glorious about Vathek's death, and he blames his mother for his influence for her influence over his will, acknowledging her sublimity, at least to some degree. So, like, we're meant to compare.
Yeah. Temporary triumph as opposed to non-triumph with left agony is what it's got.
So, my last point on this, Faxnald argues that Vathek might also be read as a tribute to a transgressive evil lifestyle. However, although Carathis has access to powers associated with Eblis, she does not subject herself to him. Instead, what is fundamental to her characterization is her independent sublimity, which provides her with influence over her son and power that even Eblis respects. Contrary to what Faxnald implies, the devil does not liberate her. She liberates herself, and that is me, that is Capstick. Don't steal that.
Faxnald ended at evil lifestyle.
So yeah, I think she's cool. In Our Ladies of Darkness, which is facts not, he says, men often need to conjure certain numinous images of women, which usually have little or nothing to do with real women. These illusions, whether Madonna or succubus, become delusions only when men forget that they are signs men themselves create to guide their way through life, love, and death. And I take issue with that. But I think Carathis is kind of separate. You know, Vathek establishes her as a really interesting figure because she is a mother, but doesn't kind of associate herself with those things. In fact, she liberates herself from those things, and she's like a witch on her own terms. So yeah,
a witch on her own terms, a witch out on the town, stealing the throne of Solomon.
So that is like our discussion on Vathek. and its engagement with the Gothic and the dark hero tradition. There's probably more you could discuss here, even just the focus on architecture in the text, or how it becomes a subgenre of the Gothic in some more detail, but I think those are kind of the main points for what we're trying to do here. Do you have anything else to add?
No, but in fact, like, looking back on the plot of Vathek, I just have more questions, and I feel like I understand the plot less, but the characters more.
Yeah, the order in which things happen, it's like present stimulus, stuff happens, damnation.
Yeah.
Everything in the middle is just soupy nonsense.
That's actually every single morality book.
Well, the others make more sense. Like, Moll Flanders has like a plot, you know?
Yeah. But I think, do not feel bad if you do not understand the plot of Vathek even after 17 rereads.
No, but if you're writing on it, write on it in comparison to other important Gothic heroes or heroines and the characteristics they present and how they are done in an interesting or slightly different manner. Or even just the Oriental element.
Yeah. No, nothing else to add, but like, holy crap. I forget how we used to finish these.
We say, read the book.
Ah, read the fucking text. They're too busy. They gotta watch their TikToks. They gotta make their sourdough bread. They gotta yarn. They gotta make knitting. What is it that kids do these days?
I don't know.
Start revolutions.
Not their assignments, despite being a uni costing an extravagant amount of money.
I spoke to someone the other day that was like, I can't keep studying. My head's getting too high. And I'm like, oh my god. I have one of those. I'm paying it off. Yeah.
Right, well, I'm gonna stop there.
No, I'm paying it.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.